thousands of unsolved murders dating back to the 1970s. Just ahead, find out what's being done to close this region's cold cases. Good Wednesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now too. Video on demand with our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we take your calls on Florida's cold cases. What are your questions? 549-2937. Then later, AARP age disruptor, as he's known, Bill Thomas. Plus, we'll tell you how two local CEOs ended Jacksonville's great food bank war. Yes, that sounds kind of interesting, doesn't it? All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, Duval County has more than 1,200 unsolved murders dating back to 1970. But no statewide data on these cold cases has ever been available. Now, think about it. 1,200 unsolved murders in Duval County alone. Imagine how many there are around the state. Well, now, advocates from the local group Project Cold Case hope their online database will help find justice for these many forgotten victims. We begin the hour with a closer look at the state's cold cases. Here with more, we welcome Ryan Backman of Project Cold Case. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. We're pleased to welcome in studio State Senator Aaron Bean, who has proposed legislation around cold cases. Senator, good morning.
Very good morning, Melissa.
And our own WJCT reporter, Lindsay Kilbride, has been covering the story and joins us as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Thousands of cold cases still unsolved in our area and around Florida. What are your questions and thoughts about this and efforts to get to the root of these unsolved murders? Give us a call, 549-2937, that's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect, email, tweet the show, or weigh in on our Facebook page. And in a moment, we'll hear from Senator Bean about what he's tried to do in Tallahassee around this issue. But first, Ryan Backman, let's begin with you. You began the Project Cold Case database because of a tragedy that happened to your own family, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Melissa. My dad was a victim of murder here in Jacksonville in 2009. He was shot in the back during a robbery attempt, and that case quickly went cold. And here we are, you know, 7 years later, with no leads and potentially no arrest happening. So I shifted my focus to other families that are experiencing something similar.
Trying to help them with a database where they can try to track cases, gather as much information, I guess, as possible.
Yeah. As one of these families, you start to feel like it's out of the public eye, that you know, there's no one out there that's paying attention, that's looking, that's actively publicizing your loved one's case, and we wanted to change that.
And Senator Aaron Bean, you've heard these cries from your constituents. What have you been working on in Tallahassee when it comes to cold cases for Florida?
Well, first of all, Ryan got my attention. There's a line Ryan has said. There's a line Ryan has said that it's so tragic having to deal with this with his circumstances, but what he can't get over is that no one is looking for his killer, his father's killer anymore. And we're not going to stand by and let that happen. We're going to actively seek everybody's justice for everybody and every family. So yeah, we have proposed legislation to have the state of Florida actually embrace, and with our the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, to actually create that law, that database, which would put everybody, every unsolved murder. We've got over 15,000 unsolved murders in the state of Florida. That number grows every week.
Right. And the governor vetoed, I think it was $50,000, to create a task force around this. So in the next legislative session, how do you see this issue being coming up again?
Well, there's still, yes, and first of all, yes, we are going forward with legislation. There's still not agreement among law enforcement about what facts should be released and the timing and how what should be made public about many of these cases. Yeah. We want to have clear definitions among all law enforcement so we can have a database, because no one wants to participate on it without jeopardizing any case. We've got to do something moving forward. I'm glad to team with Ryan.
Right, and we'll go to your calls in just a moment as we look at efforts to resolve this area's thousands of cold cases, unsolved murders. We want your calls, and we'll get to them in a moment at 549 2937. Our own WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride has been looking at this issue for some time. And Lindsay, how, in your research, can Florida take cues maybe from other states that have had the same problem?
Yeah, so I've done a lot of research on this. Senator Bean, all three of his bills were based on legislation that was passed in Colorado in 2007. So all sort of different versions. But what Colorado did was they had sort of a three-tiered bill that they passed in 2007. So that included the database, what Ryan actually has done on his own, a review team and a task force. And so I looked into it, and they're really not spending a ton of money on it. The main thing that they're funding is the salary of the woman who is a criminal intelligence analyst working for the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and she runs that database. So she's keeping up with all the cases. And then most of, like, the task force and the review teams, those are once appointed and the other sort of volunteers. But either way, the only thing I believe that they're even funding is sort of some travel. And so what they've done is the task force is what we wanted to do this year, or, you know, Senator Bean and Mr. Backman. And so with that, what they did in Colorado is they first identified best practices. And that to me is very important because a lot of what you hear from victims' families is that they feel like officers aren't trying anymore. They feel like there's not communication, there's not that sensitivity, they're not returning their calls, things like that. And so with the task force, they even go down to educating different law enforcement teams about how do you interact with victims' families. They have victims' families there to give presentations. They tackle every part of this. But as far as how many were solved, it was sort of hard to nail down a number that you can attribute to this bill. I know a activist, he was telling me he thinks about a dozen, maybe more. I couldn't get verification on that from Audrey Simpkins, who runs the database in Colorado. But what I could nail down is they have a review team, which is a group of people who can go from anywhere from detectives to officers who sort of look at random cases, just a few every year. And they've made five arrests just from that review team.
Okay. So, Ryan Blackman, you want these best practices instituted in Florida to take these cold cases from cold to, if not hot, I guess at least warm.
Sure, right? Absolutely. I traveled to Colorado and met with that organization that was able to pass that legislation before I ever brought it back to Florida. And they gave me their bill and said, we've already passed this. It was a bit of a struggle, but here's your roadmap. We came back, met with Senator Bean. I was grateful that he took it on. We filed that bill, you know, it's just slightly modified to represent Florida, and it gained no traction that first year. It was actually tagged with a $2.5 million bill by FDLE. So we knew that wasn't true because Colorado had done it for about $50,000. But we revised the legislation to focus more on the task force that would tackle policies and procedures within the state.
And Senator Bean, this gives us a window into the legislative process. It's tough to get a bill all the way through the process. Sometimes it takes several attempts, right?
It does.
Yeah.
And sometimes it does. But they say, Melissa, the fourth time is the charm.
Oh, really?
That's what they say.
Not the third. Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting, too. Well, lots of calls, meanwhile, as we speak to State Senator Aaron Bean, Ryan Backman of Project Cold Case, and our own reporter, Lindsay Kilbride, looking at ways to address the thousands of unsolved murders in Florida. What are your thoughts and comments right now as we go to the phones at 549-2937? Robert is in Murray Hill. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question regarding the statistics of the unsolved murders. Do those count cases where the police have arrested someone, but there's not enough evidence to prosecute, or in the case like maybe Casey Anthony, where she was prosecuted, but it didn't result in a conviction.
Right. So how is a cold case defined?
Right. There's some confusion in that, which is part of why we're trying to pass this legislation. But in the examples you gave, like the Casey Anthony case, that would not be considered a cold case. The law enforcement agency considers that cleared by exception. So not necessarily by an arrest or conviction, but they feel like they made the arrest of the right person. Jury decided otherwise, so that case would be cleared by exception. Each one of those cases is different. In a case where someone's arrested, you know, they can't just keep them in jail forever. They would have to prosecute them. So if there's not enough evidence for a trial, they release them from jail. They're not actually in jail. Those cases would be considered unsolved.
And it's 549-2937. Richard calling from downtown Jacksonville this morning. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say that maybe I'm wrong about this, but I believe a large percentage of those cases would be solved if there wasn't a culture of no snitching, no telling. I think in a lot of cases, people know or have some idea about what went on or either saw what went on. And I think we need to spend some time on trying to turn that culture around. People just don't want to get involved.
Okay, thanks, Richard. What about that? Helping the police solve these difficult cases, do you think that's a factor sometimes?
Well, you know, we've got a very active First Coast Crime Stoppers, which
yeah.
will pay significant rewards anonymously for folks that wish to come forward. But Richard brings up a point. We do need people, if we're ever going to take a step against crime, we need everybody to step up and do just that.
I was just going to say, that's one of the things we've started, why we want the database, why we think it's so important, is we want to give people that maybe have that information an opportunity, a place to go look for who to contact and what cases are still solved and unsolved. Somebody may be in a different position now than they were when this crime happened. Maybe they're out of an abusive relationship, or they're not scared, or they've cleaned up their life and they want to do the right thing. We want to make sure they have a place to go to find those cases and the
information.
And
that's your online portal.
Exactly.
Right now, projectcoldcase.org. And
right.
How many cold cases can people research right there?
Right now, our database has over 1,300
okay.
unsolved cold cases. Most of those are Duval County, Clay County, St. Johns County, and cases that have been submitted by families that actually are outside of Jacksonville and even Florida.
549-2937. What are your questions about efforts to get through this huge backlog of unsolved murders, cold cases in our area and in Florida? 549-2937. Mike is on the road. Hi, Mike. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi,
good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This sounds like a great project. My heart goes out to anybody that has been impacted by something like this. And I can certainly understand the desire to have some closure and get more information and help people get access to that. Two questions. One is, can you gave a little bit of elaboration about people being able to call, check the database and find out more information. But realistically speaking, what kind of impact has this database had on Colorado's cold cases? And more importantly, can you give a little bit more dimension to how this database can be used, not just by people, but by law enforcement, whatnot, on how to solve these cold cases? I think I haven't heard much about that so far yet on this segment, which is great, by the way.
Yeah.
And I think if you could connect some of those dots, it would help us understand why the database is so important.
Sure. And here's a tweet from a listener asking the same thing. He says, if Colorado can't verify or confirm results, why would we want to replicate it here in Florida?
So I can answer the Colorado part. Maybe Ryan can take the second part. When I spoke to Audrey Simpkins, who runs the database, she said the main thing that it did was really bring it to the public eye, that this is something that the public should look at and that officers should look at and, law enforcement. And she said what it really did was connect agencies. So it connected, a forensic department and prosecutors, it made everyone sort of start working together more.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it brings awareness and...
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that cases aren't being solved because of this. She was hesitant to put a number on it. You know, she works for the government there, the state. So,
Senator Bean, what do you think?
You know, what I want this cold case to or the database to do is just bring hope. I've met with dozens of other families like the Backmans that have no hope. They have no hope. Because no one is looking for their killer. There's no justice. Not only is there no justice for the family, but there's a killer out there that may do it again. So we're going to bring hope with this database to bring hope. I want Ryan to explain, what can somebody do on this database? What can they look for, and how is it going to help solve a case?
Right. So it's great that we could segue into this, because we see the database as a more multifaceted thing. First of all, hope. I mean, it's huge. These families that know that there is somewhere online where they can go, where they can steer people to be able to prove that someone still cares. That's worth it, period. Mm-hmm. But beyond that is, we have an opportunity for media, for research students, for concerned citizens, and ultimately for someone with information. We have a clearinghouse, a central hub where they can go to find information. I use the analogy or the situation where you were at a club and something happened in the parking lot and you just got out of there. And you never thought any more about it. And then 5 years later, you and your buddies are talking and you think, oh, remember that night there was a shooting at the club and we got out of there? I wonder whatever happened. Mm-hmm. Right now, you can't just go and Google, you know, that club's name and find out if that case is unsolved or if there was an arrest was made. We now are providing that opportunity. We also, as far as concerned citizens go, we've allowed search criteria such as by zip code. So you can go to our database and you can type in your zip code. And I ask you this, when you do it, think of the number in your head that is okay, the okay amount of unsolved murders in your neighborhood. What number are you all right with? And then type in your zip code and see how many you have.
Let's go to John in San Marco. Hi, John. Good morning.
Good morning, beautiful, and thank you for your help today.
Well, thank you for being so nice. What's your comment?
I'm going to try to connect a few ideas. If I'm not clear, let me know. But I see this as a systemic problem in society, especially Florida, very concentrated in Jacksonville, extremely. A couple of callers ago, someone mentioned the snitching and all that, and it's just another way of blaming victims. In other words, we take it off of law enforcement and law and order. My point is, we have a heavy-handed system here for those that are accused. There's absolutely no mercy, no empathy, no sympathy. And for those that are victims, you know, thousands of rape cases are untested. And my question is, do you think this lack of caring, sympathy, empathy towards other humans, which is so prevalent in Jacksonville, is connected that most of these jobs, 90, 80, 90% of these jobs, law enforcement, law and order, all the people involved, Angela Corey, are white, straight, privileged people, mostly men. Thousands of rape cases weren't tested, and everyone involved in the decision were men.
Yeah, and John, you know, I completely appreciate your point of view. Thanks for the call, but let's try to also keep the focus on how some of these cases can be solved. Which Lindsay.
Yeah, and I think he brought up a good point, though, with the rape kits, because now that we are testing them, they could connect the dots for a lot of the unsolved.
Between unsolved rapes mm-hmm. and unsolved murders.
Right, a lot of rapists may also be murderers.
And
so.
John is right, though. The rape kit case fiasco of the state of Florida not processing assault evidence kits in a timely manner is a state embarrassment. The legislature moved this year to address that the problem, and hopefully going forward, we can have a very timely processing of evidence and go
John,
after bad guys.
And John, thanks for that call. Let's take one more call. Loman on the south side. Go ahead, Loman.
Lomax.
Okay. Typo, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with the previous caller about our neighbors and the family needs to talk in secret. You know, some of them's even harboring some of these murders.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And you know what else, Ryan? In Duval County, public safety is always a matter of concern, where we have off and on been the state's murder capital for a long time.
Right, right.
So in particular, this is of interest, I think, to people in Duval County.
It is. And it should be of interest to every citizen in the state of Florida, because as Senator Bean mentioned, you know, it's one thing for me to care because the person that killed my dad is still out there. But the person that killed my dad is is in line behind your husband at the grocery store, you know, is walking through the parking lot of your child's school. These are murderers on our streets. This is a public safety issue. It is bigger than my dad. It is bigger than me. It's bigger than Duval County. And one thing I wanted to mention about, you know, the number that are solved directly, you know, connected to these databases is it's hard to tell because, like, on our database, we're not taking those tips. You know, we're not asking people to contact me so that I can give the information to law enforcement. We're directing them straight to law enforcement or Crime Stoppers, which means when that tip comes in, they may or may not say, oh, I saw this on a statewide database or the cold case database, the Project Cold Case holds. That's not the important part of the information. It's not how they get solved. It's that they get solved and that we give people as many opportunities as possible to do that.
And Senator Aaron Bean, you mentioned that sometimes the fourth time's the charm for legislation. I guess this will be the second pass at it the next time you bring it up, correct?
Well, we've got work to do. We've done a great job of bringing up awareness. We did what FDLE said. FDLE said, give us the money and we can do this. We got them the money and it ended up getting vetoed through a message of, this is not what FDLE requested. And so we think we're going to do a little extra work this year to make that happen. But let me brag on Ryan, because when we met Ryan 4 years ago, there's a natural inclination for government to get involved and make this happen. I believe that, and I'm going to make sure that the state of Florida plays a part in this. But Ryan hasn't waited for government to take action. Ryan says, we're going to do this ourselves. So Ryan has had his own fundraisers for Project Cold Case. He's done things himself, has organized volunteers to make this happen and I'm embarrassed to say, the state of Florida hasn't played a role and hasn't played the role that it will play down the road. But Ryan, hats off to you and the people that have put this together.
Yeah, and Lindsay Kilbride, what else can people do to learn more about this and get involved besides going to the website?
Well, I've done some stories on it. I'm sure you can connect with Ryan. And I don't know. I mean, I guess just
one of the biggest things we can have is we have a Facebook page and we do cold case spotlights weekly. And if people could just like, share, comment on those posts, the more people that see it, we don't need a million people to see it. We need one, the right one, to see these cases.
And the website, again, is projectcoldcase.org. Creator Ryan Backman here, State Senator Aaron Bean, and our own reporter Lindsay Kilbride. Thanks so much for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Always a pleasure.
And much more still ahead later in the hour. Find out why two local CEOs decided to call a truce to Jacksonville's great food bank war. You might not have even known about that. We'll tell you about it. But up next, AARP age disruptor Bill Thomas. Back in a moment.
I'm Rick Mullaney, Director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for WJCT's quarterly program, Policy Matters. On each installment, we look at how public policy affects our lives. Join the conversation as we speak with Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry and Greg Anderson, President of the Jacksonville City Council. That's on the next Policy Matters, Thursday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
A grad student's struggle with depression.
I was feeling isolated. I was crying at Cheerios commercials, which is not normal.
And the struggle to make her parents understand.
You never noticed any of that?
No.
Well, it actually has been a problem for me.
Our series on sharing stories of mental health later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef My Fam, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
on the next Fresh Air. As we approach Memorial Day weekend, we talk with J. Cale Weston about visiting the graves of Marines whose deaths he feels personally responsible for because he sent them on the mission in which their helicopter crashed. Weston has written a memoir about his 7 years in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, working as a State Department advisor. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. He's a noted author and international authority on geriatric medicine and elder care. Dr. Bill Thomas, AARP's age disruptor, as he's known, appears here at WJCT Studios later today. Thomas will be giving a master's level class and discussion on disrupt aging. Now, that's a movement challenging outdated beliefs and sparking new conversations about how people can live and age well. Dr. Bill Thomas, good morning.
Good morning.
This is so exciting. I'm really interested in hearing about age disruption. What is age disruption?
Well, actually, we're living in the middle of a silent revolution where a new kind of aging is emerging right before our eyes.
And how? And you are you an example of that, I would guess?
Well, I'm 56, uh-huh. So I'm wake up every morning. It seems I'm one day older. So I do think I'm getting that part right.
Right.
But really, the big story culturally is that the old idea of age being simply a matter of decline—that's all there is to it. End of conversation. Is now morphing into a really complicated, interesting vision of aging that includes growth mm-hmm. and development.
And you're going to be sharing this as sort of a master class here at WJCT later today. What are some of the things people will learn?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in taking people behind the curtain, so to speak. You know, taking people behind what is on the surface. And so we're going to be exploring what really science shows is the true nature of human aging, which is actually very different than the cultural stereotype of aging.
What are the differences between the stereotype and the reality?
Well, I'll give you an example. The process, the physiological body process we call aging, actually begins when we turn 28.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you're 48 years old, for example, you've been aging for 20 years.
And how were they able to determine that scientifically? That's kind of fascinating.
Well, I'll give you an example. If you've ever been on a treadmill and looked at that, sometimes I'll have a little graph that shows maximum heart rate.
Uh-huh.
And you see the peak on the maximum heart rate. It's in the late 20s, and then the curve very gently
starts to slide slopes. A certain way. Sean Birch, it's all downhill from here.
Yeah.
He's nodding his head.
Yeah. Congratulations. Are you aging?
He's just started, apparently, according to what we've just learned. It just started like 5 minutes ago. But I think he'll be fine. Okay. So this is an opportunity for people to not only learn this stuff, but also, I guess, recast their thinking about
right.
their lives.
Yeah. So if you're going to, if you have a big part of life that involves your body behaving in a certain kind of way, if you've got that and you have a choice between knowing what the research shows and what the science tells us mm-hmm. or relying on tabloid stereotypes, I'm going to go with the research.
Sure. And how does the research give people, I guess, a joie de vivre, a confidence about the stage of life that they're in?
Yeah, so that's a great point, actually. There's one of the things we'll talk about is a psychological phenomenon called priming. And what that means is when we're exposed to certain messages that tell us, I'll give you an example, tells young girls, you're no good at math.
Yeah.
Actually, girls are great at math.
Right.
Just as good as boys. But you get these messages and then you start to believe them and you wind up with fewer women in engineering, which is a tragedy in my opinion. So with aging, people hear messages that say, oh no, you know, oh, you can't do that. Oh no, that's not possible. And what we're out is disrupting those priming messages.
What are some of those most harmful priming messages you'd like to disrupt?
Number one, old age is a sad time of life.
Ah.
You know, the research says
The opposite, right?
The opposite. It's really true.
The older people get, the happier
they
get.
Yes,
they
do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
If you look at the relationship between mortality, the risk of death, and happiness.
I know, it's kind of funny.
It is very funny. It's beautiful and it's awesome and amazing. And these are the things that our culture is not yet ready to deal with.
What are some other ones?
I would say, for example, that we were talking about heart rate, or muscle mass. I'll give you an example. If you look at the skeletal muscle mass, you know, body muscle mass of men, you find that it declines about 1% a year.
Uh-huh.
That's normal. And in our culture, we define that as a bad thing. But in fact, old men are not supposed to be starting fights in bars. And they've got a different role to play, different way of being in the world.
Right.
And so the fact that you've lost this muscle mass is actually setting you up for a different way of living. So there you have a scientific fact and an interpretation of it that disrupts the narrative of decline.
When people come to your workshops, what's the difference like between when they come in and sit down, you know, their body language, how they're behaving, and how they are when they go out?
I think that just tell you, I mean, sparkling eyes and big smiles, because, you know, if you live in a society that tells you that what lies ahead is very bad, and then you get real evidence that what lies ahead is complicated and difficult and amazing and challenging and beautiful, that's more like life as we know it, not a stereotype, not a comic book tragedy.
Well, it's going to be a well-attended, exciting talk, and it's coming up in just a few hours here at WJCT. Space is limited. I think you can still register, though, if you go to...
I think there's a couple of spaces left.
Yeah, just a few left at aarp.org/events. This afternoon at 3:30, the discussion kicks off, followed by a reception with Dr. Bill Thomas, AARP's Age Disruptor. It's fascinating. Come on out for this master's level class and discussion on disrupt aging right here at WJCT today. Dr. Thomas, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And we're back in a moment.
Spend some time in the Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
This isn't news, I know, but getting kids to eat healthy isn't always the easiest thing.
We have put fruits and vegetables in front of children, but they aren't necessarily being eaten.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have got the answer. Seriously. Also, the rest of the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Transportation Security Administration is under fire for long, slow airport screening lines and allegations of mismanagement. The latest on airport security at home, the shakeup at the TSA, and the investigation into the latest Egypt Air crash.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's called JEA Hydrologic. It's a living outdoor exhibit at Jacksonville's Museum of Science and History. And what it does is encourage efficient water use for landscaping your home lawn and your garden. It also features a giant mural painted by celebrated local artist Sean Thurston. In today's Going Green here on the show, we're going to take a closer look as we welcome the artist and also MOSH director Maria Hain. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And I think of MOSH exhibits as scientific, as learning all about our natural world. I didn't necessarily think of them as green and sustainable. This is exciting, and you're really moving aggressively into this space. Can you tell us about this exhibit?
Sure. This exhibit, as you mentioned, is a living exhibit. It models practices that residents and businesses can put into effect at home based on 8 principles. This is about water conservation using drought-resistant plantings and inviting the wildlife into your yard, which then can reduce pests and reduce the use of pesticides and the runoff into our river.
And you've brought an artistic component into it. Mm-hmm. Sean Thurston, you're known around town for your incredible artwork. There's a giant mural as part of JEA Hydrologic. What did you paint? What will people see?
Oh, well, as you come around to the parking area, you'll actually see an astronaut floating against the galaxy, but that comes down into the Florida landscape, and then it ties into almost a root system of the Florida aquifer, which will transition into the plants.
Was that fun to work on?
Yeah, I mean, I love being on a lift like 40 feet in the air. It's it's an interesting view.
Yeah, and it's I assume it, going 40 feet up, how long did it take you to do a piece that large?
Well, I had great weather, so 3 weeks.
Wow.
Beginning to end, I was done, and then they came in and UV coated it. So
it's up. Finished. And this is called JEA Hydrologic, so the utility is involved.
Yes, the utility is involved. Well, water conservation is critical to Duval County, but as well to our nation and our world for that matter. So JEA has a real stake in the water use and water conservation.
And what's your hope for this exhibit in terms of motivating people to think about these issues, you know, the art of it, the educational aspect of it, mm-hmm. in motivating people in this direction?
Yeah, well, it's all about behavior change and the collective impact. And if we can change, if everyone can make a commitment to go back to their residents and their businesses and make a few changes, then we impact the quality of our river. We impact the amount of water that we are using, which we're using faster than the earth can replenish. Mm-hmm. So it's really critical to our future. It really is, as you mentioned in the beginning, it's a sustainable practice. So mm-hmm. if we can all make some small behavior changes, we can collectively impact our future.
What have people commented on when they've seen the mural, Sean? How has it impacted people?
I think the biggest impact is with the busloads of children that are walking into the museum. I went out there before the mural was painted and kind of watched the reactions, and they were full of questions of even what kind of building they were walking into, and now it's pretty clear. Like, it's a nice preemptive image for them to get ready to learn, and it starts showing them the relationship between, like, the plants, animals, water, Florida, man, and the history of Florida all the way up into the space program. So they know they're walking into a place of learning before they even come through the front door.
Excellent. And now you launched this on Earth Day, right?
We did.
How long is it active?
Well, actually, the space will be, as I'm saying now, we're busting out of the museum walls with our exhibits. So this is a permanent exhibit that will continue to grow and thrive. So it will continue on display outside of the museum. A really important factor here is really the partnerships that brought all of this together and to activate the outside of the space. MOSH's Young Supporters Group, The Elements, have been key. They actually were the ones that raised the money and funded Sean's work and got community partners. But more than 13 community partners came together to create this educational exhibit.
Kudos. Well, go see this at MOSH. It's JEA Hydrologic, our Going Green Spotlight for today. Maria Hain, Executive Director at the Museum of Science and History, artist Sean Thurston, we so appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to see you.
In a moment, keep listening because we'll tell you all about the truce called in Jacksonville's Great Food Bank Battle. That's next.
This Going Green segment is brought to you by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jacksonville.
In 1971, Robert Rosenthal was working an entry-level job for the New York Times when an editor called with a story of a lifetime.
He says, I want you to come to room 1111 at the Hilton Hotel tomorrow, and don't tell anyone where you're going.
and bring enough clothes for at least a month.
And down the rabbit hole we go.
I slept in a room with two huge filing cabinets. I slept with the Pentagon Papers.
On the next episode of Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
It never happens at a good time. Only momentous occasion. Under the spotlight when history demands you say just the right thing and you've got nothing. On the next Snap Judgment, we proudly present A Loss for Words. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, for about 2 years, you might not have known about this, but a couple of local nonprofits were waging a very public feud in what local media had dubbed the food bank war of the city. But now a new partnership has been formed and a truce, sort of, focusing on everything from feeding the hungry in this area to helping refugees and AIDS patients and more. New leaders from both organizations have buried the hatchet and are collaborating. We're going to tell you all about it as we welcome Luke Leo, CEO of Feeding Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Mary Strickland, President of Lutheran Social Services.
Good morning.
All right, let's start with the background. Mary, you're the new CEO at LSS, which for years ran the major food bank in this city. Mm-hmm. Why don't we go back to 2014 when things started to go south? Can you let's bring the listeners up to date.
Well, I'm new to LSS, and I'm actually new to Jacksonville, so I wasn't actually in the city when all of this happened. But from my understanding is that there was a food bank at LSS called Second Harvest, and apparently there were some issues with the food bank, with Feeding America, and there was a parting of the ways, so to speak, with Second Harvest then became Feeding Northeast Florida, and that's where Luke comes in.
Right. You replaced Bruce Ganger, who parted ways somewhat acrimoniously from Lutheran Social Services. You began running the area's major food bank.
Correct.
Yeah.
And Feeding America was moving to a model of independent food banks. You know, this is all that you do. And, you know, LSS does wonderful things, which Mary can certainly talk more about, refugee relief being one of them, and work in the AIDS community. When Feeding America pulled that contract, as you know, they took Bruce Ganger, my predecessor, who was the executive director of the food bank, and stood up Feeding Northeast Florida. So we're actually this next Friday, June the 3rd, is our 2-year anniversary of being in existence as we are today.
That's great. And there were lawsuits, counter lawsuits. There was a lot of sniping in the local press. The two of you decided to get together and put all that behind the organizations.
Yes. And in fact, when I arrived at my job at LSS, I found in my mailbox a letter from Luke welcoming me to LSS and welcoming me to Jacksonville. And so it was funny because I was going to call Luke myself. And so we quickly met and realized we had a lot. We were already working on a lot of things together. I mean, in fact, Feeding Northeast Florida has given us about 104,000 pounds of food this year because we still have a food pantry and we still do a mobile pantry. So we're collaborating with Feeding Northeast Florida. So I do have to say, you know, I was very pleased to get that from Luke, and it was very welcoming. And it also sort of indicative of the Jacksonville community.
And so everyone understands now, Feeding Northeast Florida is taking the lead on food bank services. Lutheran Social Services has decided to focus on other things, right?
We are more focused more on our refugee program. We are focused on our AIDS program. We still have a nourishment network. And we also have our homelessness prevention program, which is called Rep Payee. So we're very busy. For example, we're resettling several refugee families this week alone. So we're quite busy doing that. And we're really moved away from the food bank business.
And you need to reach a certain fundraising milestone on the refugee program.
Yes, we have a wonderful program we've been running in Englewood High School for 16 years where we help teenagers who are coming from war-torn families, war-torn countries, rather. They're coming to the United States for the first time. They're in high school. They don't speak our language. So we have teachers in the schools at Englewood. And we're trying to promote that program because we've lost our state funding for a few months. We need some gap funding. So we're actually doing a kickoff of our fundraising program at hashtag We Understand Jax, and that's on our website at lssjax.org. So, yes, we're doing some fundraising for our refugee youth students.
Okay, and at the same time, Feeding Northeast Florida has really gotten aggressive in expanding operations and distributing food to people in this area across 17 Northeast Florida counties. What's on the agenda for the rest of this year?
Well, what we're finding to be very beneficial, both operationally and you know, in keeping the quality of the food up, is what we call our spoken hub model. So we're going to continue to look for hubs that we can roll out. We've got them in Clay County and Nassau County, at Beam and Jacks Beach. And this allows us to distribute food directly from retailers to those locations. The primary factor being that they have cooling. They've got refrigeration and freezers. So we're continually looking for partners in strategic areas to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think that the real message with Mary and I being here, and it answers your question as well, is growing what we do, but more importantly, the impact that we have in the community through partnerships. And, you know, this is a great example of one. I mean, we are the Feeding America Food Bank. We have 180 agencies that we work with as partners. They're one of the agencies that we work with. And as Mary said, more than 100,000 pounds of food, which translated to roughly $180,000 worth of food in the past year. But they do things that we don't do. And, you know, we were looking at ways that we could collaborate. You know, they put these refugees in apartments. And so I said, well, could we stock the pantry and stock the refrigerator?
Things right. Like that. Things like that. And so often there are so many wonderful nonprofits in this community. But I think if there's a criticism of that sector, it's that so many groups are working in silos.
Yes.
Or duplicating services. This was a really prominent example of that a few years ago when this all erupted. So what example do you think you're setting for other nonprofit leadership when in the way that the two of you have figured out ways to collaborate?
Well, I think we're here for the mission. I know I'm here for the mission, and so is Luke, and so we have to collaborate. There are plenty of people in need in Jacksonville. There are plenty of services that we need. And with all the services we provide, it's not just food. We provide resettlement. We provide English services. We provide counseling to patients. And then Luke has another set of services he provides. So I think for all of us to be effective, we have to collaborate. We have to.
Yeah. This is one really nice happy ending to something that was kind of ugly and contentious. So I'm excited to end the show on this. What else are you hoping to collaborate on?
Well, we're working together right now on some senior coalitions. I know that we've got members of both of our teams working together on that. But, you know, Feeding America's model nationally is moving towards, you know, realizing that feeding people is just part of the solution. So the more we can partner with mental health agencies and job training agencies and, you know, agencies that work in the AIDS community and with refugees, that's how we're going to, you know, holistically tackle some of the challenges that we have. So I hope this is inspiring to other nonprofits and a good example of doing just that.
That's right. Absolutely. And you can learn more about both of these wonderful organizations just by going to their websites. Lutheran Social Services is at lssjacks.org. Feeding Northeast Florida is at feedingnefl.org. And we're so pleased to welcome the CEOs of both groups to the program, now working together, not at odds anymore. Mary Luke, thanks so much for being with us, and keep us posted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's our show. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and watch the show now, too, with video on demand at our partner, TVJax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, the Transportation Security Administration is under fire for long, slow airport screening lines and allegations of mismanagement. The latest on airport security at home, the shakeup at the TSA, and the investigation into the Egypt Air crash, that's all coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Tomorrow, our quarterly program, Policy Matters, will air, and we'll be back on Friday. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.